are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, May 30th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Marcy Wheeler on Mueller's handoff to Congress and the question, will they fumble it? Meanwhile, how a drape over the U.S. John McCain explains Trump's collusion. In Israel, Bibi fails big time. Israel to hold an unprecedented second election as Netanyahu can't form a coalition government. And the Republicans and Wilbur Ross are about to find out that in the digital age, the dead do in fact tell tales. The Republican census plot exposed crazy story. Meanwhile, Louisiana passes the latest fetal palpitation bill signed by Democratic Governor John Bel Edwards. China escalates its trade war, or our trade war, halts soy purchases. And the CEO of Cigna Health Insurance supposedly threatened Connecticut as they were contemplating a public option. And new report, incompetent rich people are more likely to get ahead than smart people with no money. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. We got a lot to go through today. There are two stories. I didn't headline the Ben Shapiro story of yesterday, that there was an incident in Indiana, I think it was, right? And we're not going to get into it now, but a synagogue was vandalized by a neo-Nazi who had been radicalized with the help of his wife. His wife was radicalized in part, according to her testimony,
the defense,
in depositions, by Ben Shapiro. And I said something somewhat flippantly, but I thought was certainly possible yesterday, that Ben Shapiro's good Jews and bad Jews may explain how someone like Ben Shapiro, not necessarily has to be an Orthodox Jew, but in Ben Shapiro's case, I think it is specific to that. Or an Orthodox Jew with Ben Shapiro's perspective on things, you could draw a line between what Ben Shapiro says and the actions of a neo-Nazi. Why would a neo-Nazi take any inspiration from Ben Shapiro? We will go deep into that today, maybe in the fun half. But there is now compelling evidence that that is exactly the case. We will talk about that and this story about these hard drives found that belonged to a Republican operative who was considered the godfather of the Republican redistricting gerrymandering program, I think from 2010. And these hard drives reveal that the census question that the administration wants to put on the census about citizen status is not just about terrifying immigrants, but has a specific, calculated, modeled agenda to help Republicans win in elections. And there are two cases that are in front of the Supreme Court that this is going to have bearing on, in my estimation. One is of the question of the census question, which is up. I mean, they're weeks away from deciding on it, maybe not even weeks. And the other is a gerrymander question about intense partisan gerrymandering. And we'll talk about that, too, as the program progresses. But we're going to get into stuff with Marcy Wheeler. But before we do, many of you have probably seen this story. It's all over the place that on his trip to Japan, Donald Trump, famous for having an issue with John McCain having an issue with Donald Trump. They didn't like each other, folks. There is a warship called the USS John McCain. It was named after John McCain's dad. When John McCain passed, they recommissioned it as being named after both of them. Donald Trump did not go to that ship and speak to the the seamen who are in and around Japan, stationed in Japan. He went to a smaller boat called the Wasp, I think it is. And my friend Larry, who was a naval seaman himself, Larry Murphy, tells me that boat's small. That's a weird boat for someone to go on at the time. And it has come out that apparently the White House not only wanted to avoid the USS John McCain, but put a drape over the name while he was around so that he didn't see it. And none of the seamen, I think, stationed on that boat were allowed to hear his talk. I mean, classy stuff. Here is Donald Trump explaining that he didn't know anything about it. It was his underlings. It's a wonderful exercise in watching Donald Trump's cowardice. But it also, I think, has some relevance to what we're going to be discussing today in terms of the Mueller report. Here is Donald Trump.
To the sailors at the John McCain, that they were banned from hearing you speak simply because they serve.
I don't know what happened. I wasn't involved. I would not have done that. I was very angry with John McCain because he killed health care. I was not a big fan of John McCain in any way, shape, or form. I think John McCain had a lot to getting President Bush, a lot to do with it, to go into the Middle East, which was a catastrophe. To me, John McCain, I wasn't a fan. But I would never do a thing like that. Now, somebody did it because they thought I didn't like him, okay? And they were well-meaning, I will say. I didn't know anything about it. I would never have done that.
You owe the sailors, the McCain, an apology.
No, not at all. I heard sailors all went on. We had a tremendous group of sailors from various ships. It was a beautiful day. But the McCain thing, I knew nothing about.
Okay. Now, maybe you can choose to believe Donald Trump or not choose to believe Donald Trump here. That's irrelevant. The fish rots from the head down. And the head of the fish is certainly rotted. There's no reason to believe the rest of the carcass is not also rotted. But what this also exemplifies was something that we were talking about when the Mueller report was issued. And again, you don't have to read the whole report. Read the first two chapters. You'll get all you need to know. It was clear that Mueller's task was very narrow in terms of looking at the question of what we colloquially call collusion. But there is, of course, no legal There is no crime you can commit with collusion. He had to look at something very specific, which was a very specific conspiracy charge, wherein, with the two things that the Russian government was involved in, that is the hacking and leaking of the emails, and in the social media shenanigans, did anyone from the Trump campaign actively coordinate with those people to do that stuff? Did they trade material aid to each other, essentially, in doing it? And he found that they did not. Or I should say, he did not find sufficient evidence to find that they did. That's more accurate. He specifically, Mueller, or the report specifically says, we do not in any way, that does not in any way mean that we didn't find the two parties weren't working in concert. In other words, that, and they go on to say that one party did something that the other party reacted to. The second party did something that the first party reacted to, but they never coordinated those things. It's almost as if, like, you know or anticipate what the other person wants and then goes ahead and does it. So maybe Donald Trump doesn't say to any of his staff, I hate John McCain. And if I go there, I don't want to see his ship and I don't want to talk and I want to actually disgrace the ship in some way by taking it out on the sailors. Maybe Donald Trump did not say that. Maybe we believe Donald Trump, that his staff knows that he hates John McCain and goes and does something that they know will be pleasing to his staff. I mean, to him. And then Donald Trump is like, you guys did that and gave me deniability. I'm not going to coordinate anything with you, but here's a raise. Here's some job security. You see the point there. There's collusion in some fashion. They know what each other wants. But there's no conspiracy because they haven't coordinated it.
Won't someone rid me of this troublesome aircraft carrier?
Indeed. And I think if you read the report, you see that there's a lot of that. I mean, if you have the other 30,000 emails, Russia, go ahead. The Russians are thinking, do you think Donald Trump wants to win? Yes. Let's talk to someone not affiliated with the campaign. Is this a good time to drop these emails when this tape comes out?
This also might be why the Trump administration is so understanding about Mohammed bin Salman and Jamal Khashoggi.
Yeah. Sometimes people just get the idea that they want something done and they do it. And you can't, you know, these things happen.
It came from a good place. Their heart was in the right
place. Their heart was in the right place. Yeah. Meanwhile, the second clip we have for you today is also relevant to having Marcy on. And really the question of impeachment. This is pretty stunning. And we played some of the clips from the Justin Amash town hall, where he had a tremendous amount of support for his calls to impeach Donald Trump based upon the Mueller report. I think there's a lot of people who would argue you don't need the Mueller report to impeach Donald Trump, but it's nice to have multiple accounts. And the argument that many people are making about impeachment, despite the fact that it doesn't poll as well as one would want to go ahead with it, is that there's a huge contingency of people in this country who are not aware of what's in that report. I would include virtually all of you listening to me, because I know almost none of you have read it. I know almost none of you have read it. But you're aware of summations of it, so you have a general gist. There's a clip from this Justin Amash thing that I think in some ways is is sort of mind-blowing, and it's just a good reminder that we don't know what the F a certain segment of the population, a large segment of the population, is exposed to on a daily basis and what their perspective is on these things. We can talk about Ben Shapiro, although he is now on right-wing talk radio. We can talk about, you know, Jordan Peterson, Dave Rubin. I mean, that's where the kids. But when you talk about people ages 40 to 70 in this country who are conservative, the main source of their news is not just Fox. In fact, it's not Fox. It is right-wing radio. And if you listen to right-wing radio, you are living in a completely different universe than everyone else. And here is an example of that. This is from Lawrence O'Donnell caught this clip. It's pretty amazing.
Supporters were outraged and others were confused. One Republican who attended the congressman's town hall said that she didn't know there was anything negative about President Trump in the Mueller report until Congressman Amash started talking about it.
I was surprised to hear there was anything negative in the Mueller report at all about President Trump. I hadn't heard that before, and I mainly listened to conservative news, and I hadn't heard anything negative about that report, and President Trump had been exonerated.
I mean, where could, where would you ever get the notion that all of the completely exonerated, all the charges obliterated in the report? Fox News, right-wing radio, and people and guests who go on those shows. Guests who are really concerned about misinformation and hoaxes and whatnot. That is why any calculation that anyone makes about polling regarding impeachment is largely irrelevant. Because it presumes that people know what's there. And the fact is they don't. You go back, and as big as that grab them by the P-word tape was, not as many people heard it as we thought, I think, at the time. Clinton's emails dropped strategically right on that day or the day after that tape got released. And not as many people were aware of it, I think, as we thought at the time. So those are the two clips we're playing before Marcy Wheeler gets on. Just a reminder, you can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. You support the free show, and then we give you extra content every day. We'll be right back. Marcy Wheeler.
There is a love for sale. There's a hundred.
We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. I want to say it's a pleasure to have her on, and it is for me. But I do want to start off by issuing an apology to her for having her on. I think that's what I'm supposed to do. Marcy Wheeler, I'm sorry. I'm sorry that you have to do this.
And I'm sorry, Sam, that you're going to catch no end of crap for this from certain quarters. So
That crap is not going to end either way. I mean, folks, there's a white knuckled quality to some people want to argue. Folks can tune into Tucker Carlson, I think, if you want to see more of that. But with that said, So Marcy, we have not had you on since the Mueller report dropped. And yesterday, Robert Mueller ended the whole thing for the most part, as far as I can tell. So let's just start with this. There was in Politico a piece that said something to the effect of maybe what Robert Mueller was just basically reiterating what's in the report, and he wasn't saying anything new, and people are making too much of a big deal of it. He just reiterated what was in the report. Just before we get into to a lot more of the specifics of that, what's your take on that take? The idea that Robert Mueller just got up there, he didn't say anything new. He just was reiterating it. Here, let me read it, okay, to you.
Yeah.
It's misjudging Mueller. At the end of the day, all Robert Mueller really did was reiterate what was in Volume 2 of his report. He wasn't allowed to indict the president for anything, so the special counsel's office didn't consider it. To the extent that he leaned into the idea of impeachment, all he did was note the fact that it was up to others, Congress, to figure that out. Maybe Robert Mueller is exactly who we thought he was, someone who follows the rules to the letter and views his mission in the narrowest terms possible. And maybe folks on the left are investing too much of their hopes in a guy who doesn't want the entire weight of American democracy on his shoulders and never has. But what's your take on that take?
I think, let me just start by saying, because I'll start by, making your brain hurt, but he did not end the whole thing yesterday. He ended his investigation yesterday, and I'll get back to why that's important.
Okay.
I think it is true that he substantially said this is what's in the report, but I think it's important because very few people have reported correctly on what is in the report. In other words, there's been a lot of disinformation, for example. I mean, one of the things he said yesterday, which was very subtly different from the report, but people are understanding entirely differently, is he said there wasn't enough evidence to charge a wider conspiracy. Very simple sentence, right? A very similar one appears on page 2 of the Mueller report that says, just because we say that that we did not establish a certain set of facts doesn't mean there was evidence. There was no evidence of a certain set of facts. I can't tell you, Sam, how many times I've said, please go read page 2 for that and one other reference on it. Because people, whether they're right-wing denialists, left-wing denialists, good reporters, people with JDs, I've heard them over and over again say there was no evidence of a conspiracy. And it's like, no, there was evidence of a conspiracy. Just for a variety of reasons, there was not enough evidence of a conspiracy to charge.
I had,
and that's important.
I had guests on this program who said, who have said that there is no evidence multiple times. They said it before they came on this program. They didn't say it when they came on this program, but they did say it after they were on this program. And Mueller made it very clear yesterday there was insufficient evidence, which is, of course,
right.
It's actually a term of art, isn't it, in prosecution?
Well, I mean, yes. And I mean, so is did not establish, but the problem was that many of the people reading the report, treated some of the legalistic language in the report, as if it were plain English. And therefore, they didn't treat the legalistic nuances of the report with any honesty, even people who have JDs. But So there was insufficient evidence to charge conspiracies. Whether, frankly, it's between just Russians or whether it's between, say, Russians and Paul Manafort or Russians and Carter Page. And again, Mueller did not go into the details of why that's true, but the report does. And in some cases, there are prosecutorial reasons for that. And in some cases, there are evidentiary reasons that go back to the issue of obstruction on that. So anyway, that's one thing that people took as new yesterday, which really wasn't new. I think it was important for Mueller to say the three key details of his logic on not prosecuting obstruction. One was he's not allowed. The second one was it's not fair to accuse the president of a crime and not give him a way to immediately say to prove his innocence, to challenge that accusation in court. And then the third was he was preserving evidence. So it's at such time. The fourth was Congress, it's your job. Get off your duff and start doing your constitutional job. I mean, that's sort of what the volume two stuff was about. And it was clearly an attempt to counteract the spin that Bill Barr gave us on March 24th. You know, so now like 6 weeks ago.
Right.
2 months ago.
And yesterday we compared and contrasted Bill Barr saying that in the March 5th conversation, Robert Mueller, did not say that the OLC findings were a but for in terms of his bringing a charge. But that was very, very narrowly tailored response, because it's clear that one of the reasons why he didn't bring a charge of conspiracy is because there was not enough evidence. But the other reason was he was not authorized to bring a charge of anything, it appears, at all. And I feel like that, I'm reading this Politico thing, like, the idea that he wasn't allowed to indict the president for anything, I don't think that's been terribly communicated to people. Politico, threw it off like everybody knows that Mueller was not allowed to indict the president for anything. I don't think people knew that, frankly.
Right.
But
right. And I also think there's been a great deal of spin about how historically prosecutors have said to Congress, hey, get off your duff. And even Ken Starr, even though he said Clinton was guilty of a crime over and over and over again, which violated the rules that Mueller himself held himself to. In other words, he could have said, yeah, this was clear obstruction, but he didn't because he's not Ken Starr. But even Ken Starr, in handing this to Congress, did not say, hey, Congress, this is an impeachment referral. So no one should expect Mueller to have said, hey, Congress, this is an impeachment referral. It was clear to people who had read it closely because he kept saying there are constitutional means to do this and right. Prosecuting is not one of them. He reemphasized that yesterday, but it was clear in the report, had people read it, it was, he kept saying over and over again, Congress, 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 we don't want to charge him because that would interrupt the actual constitutional means of holding him accountable. Congress didn't get the message, so Mueller made his statement yesterday.
Okay, so I want to go backwards here for a moment. When we've spoken in the past, you were speculating that what Mueller was going to charge various officials involved in the Trump, the Trump campaign, and potentially Donald Trump himself, was investigating was the crime of a conspiracy to defraud the United States. Give me a sense of how you have reassessed, or how you assess whether that was the charge or if he was in a position to charge, I guess, if that was what he was pursuing and where they did not have the evidentiary, what they needed in terms of evidence.
Okay, so I also think, and some prior guests on your show have said, that I claimed he definitely would charge a quid pro quo conspiracy. What I have said is there's a great deal of evidence of a quid pro quo conspiracy. That and on all of these issues, there's a very big question of whether you can hit the bar of charging the president's son. And on campaign finance issues, so on both the June 9th meeting and on getting these stolen emails released, the second one, many people don't realize, was also considered for a campaign finance crime. And on both of those, Mueller basically said, yeah, I think a crime was committed, but according to the DOJ manual, I can't charge something unless I'm pretty damn sure that I'm going to be able to get a conviction and keep the conviction on appeal. And given whom I'm dealing with and given what kind of evidence I've gotten, I'm not going to get there. And also given the First Amendment considerations involved with WikiLeaks and email releases and so on and so forth. So, and that would also go to the conspiracy to defraud thing. If you get a campaign donation and don't reveal it, then that's another way to charge that. So what he basically said is, and importantly, just as an example, Don Jr., we know from the report, never testified. He's willing to testify again to Congress, but he never testified to Mueller's people at all. There's some hints, although this is redacted, that he was subpoenaed and his lawyer told Mueller that he would invoke the Fifth Amendment if he were actually forced to come before the grand jury and so did not appear, or maybe he did and did invoke the Fifth. But just as an example, you can't charge the June 9th meeting without either getting Don Jr. to testify or Emin Agalarov to find out what he said to Don Jr. on the phone and what Don Jr. actually expected from the meeting. Emin Agalarov canceled an entire concert tour in the United States to avoid testifying to Mueller.
Now, just remind people who you're talking about. The June 9th meeting is the meeting that took place at Trump Tower. In that meeting, supposedly, was Jared Kushner, Manafort, Trump, and who was there?
Trump Jr., not Trump Sr.
Trump Jr., yeah. Right. And that and there was some question as to whether they spoke on the phone afterwards or beforehand or something to that effect. Who were the Russians in that meeting?
So the Russian who organized the meeting is Aras Agalarov, who is an oligarch who's close to Putin. He's the one who brought Trump to Moscow in 2013 for the Miss Universe pageant. So they had worked together. They had discussed a Trump Tower deal until 2015, when a new one kind of replaced it. And so he was probably the powerful Russian with closest ties to Trump. And his son has ties to Don Jr. And so his son had his concert promoter, Rob Goldstone, email Don Jr. to get a meeting. And Emin, the son, was like, get a meeting. Here's what I want you to tell him. And he got the meeting. And at the end of the meeting, this Russian lawyer, Natalia Veselnitskaya, said, hey, we want you to turn over Magnitsky sanctions. And Don Jr. said, we'll revisit it after the election. And that's where I was getting to the point of, he took a meeting for dirt. And at the end of it, he said, we will give you something in exchange for this meeting for dirt. So that's one example of where you might have gotten there. Mueller did not get there. Another place where there was clear evidence of it.
Now, just to be clear, that's the idea of a quid pro quo. And Mueller, it seems to me, in the report said the only thing that they were investigating, whether there was actually like sort of like material help or coordination in the acts that each and other did. So even it seems to me like he said, and after he stated that, right after the sentence after that, said something to the effect of like, we're not talking about people working in concert, or people making moves in concert with the other people. In other words, like, I see you do this, so I'm going to do that. And then you see I do that, so you're going to do this, and back and forth. It's there has to be like some full articulation that my doing this is contingent upon you doing that.
Yeah. And there's a lot of lawyers who will say that if you or I were being assessed for conspiracy, the evidence that Mueller had would have been far easily sufficient to charge us. But you throw in the fact that you and I can't afford the lawyers that Don Jr. can afford, and that you and I, you know, we're not the
stakes are bigger,
son.
Right? The stakes are bigger,
yeah,
right? You're
yeah.
afraid. I mean, I would be. I'm not afraid.
I mean, I think you do not want to lose a case against the president's son.
Right.
You're not going to do that. And so you're going to make crystal clear. And, you know, on the June 9th meeting, he kind of said, well, Don Jr. is too stupid to conspire, meaning that he doesn't know enough about law, about what's legal and what's not legal, to be able to say that when he accepted that meeting, he knew that he was committing a campaign finance violation. So,
and campaign finance violation, insofar as like you're getting services in kind, essentially, as opposed to like money.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And the analysis on why the emails weren't is redacted because it pertains to Roger Stone. We know, I mean, the Roger Stone stuff in the report, if people haven't read it, it's still really heavily redacted, but it's really damning because Trump was very, very closely involved in all of this. You know, he was telling Manafort, telling Gates, go figure out what's coming next. Go, you know, go get Stone to tell us what's coming next. Both Cohen has testified to this publicly. Gates appears to have testified that they witnessed Stone calling Trump and saying, here's what's coming down the pike. So in other words, Trump was really closely involved in telling Roger Stone to go optimize the WikiLeaks releases. There's new evidence in there, which your prior guests have ignored, which makes it clear that they did in fact know that Podesta's emails were coming out well in advance of them coming out. But
even if that's the case, would that still fall under what Mueller was tasked? Because it seems to me that, like, if WikiLeaks is an independent player here, coordinating.
That's a big if.
Right. It's a big if. But but presuming they are, if the Trump campaign is like getting a heads up from a publishing entity that these are coming out, that's not in any way like contributing to like you know, coordinating the actual hack of the stuff. It's just getting a heads up on the leaking of the stuff,
right? And it is clear there was a significant First Amendment consideration in that analysis. There are many things about the WikiLeaks stuff that are interesting. One is that Julian Assange just got a crazy superseding indictment. Was it last week? Is that how much time is passing? That charged him 17 counts of espionage. And that really poses a grave risk for national security reporting in this country, because it accuses him of basically saying, here's what I want you to go find. So that's the basis of like 9 charges of espionage. It accuses him of
and wants you to
helping.
Do that via basically a broadcast on his website to people, as opposed to like calling up specific people and saying, go get this for me.
Right, right. And it accuses him of helping. So that's a CFAA violation. And that was the original charge, but there was an espionage charge tacked on to the CFAA charge. That poses maybe less risk to journalism, but still does pose a risk. And then the last one is straight up publication. He was charged with 3 counts of espionage for basically releasing the identities of American and coalition force sources. So like an IIPA violation, exposing covert identities and knowing that they could pose some risk. So that's a really dangerous prosecution. But what's interesting about it is, as you said, a bunch of those charges, 9 of those charges, are based on a wish list that WikiLeaks had on its site in 2010 that allegedly Chelsea Manning was responding to when she was digging through DOD servers and finding stuff to leak to Assange. And what's interesting about that in this case is there's only one difference between the day before the Russians started hacking John Podesta, WikiLeaks issued a tweet saying, hey, do you think that we should pose a put up a reward for getting the Goldman Sachs transcripts, which the Russians did get from John Podesta's server? So in this case, in the case of John Podesta's emails, they also issued basically a wish list, and the Russian hackers the next day started hacking and obtaining that stuff. So, and then in addition, there's Trump standing there on July 27th, 2016, saying, Russia, if you're listening, can you go find these emails? And again, 5 hours later, the Russians started hacking Hillary's personal server. And so it's a real question. The one difference between those two wish lists and the ones that are in the EDVA espionage indictment is that in the 2010 wish list, WikiLeaks was asking for classified information, whereas here, WikiLeaks was basically suborning theft, and as was Donald Trump suborning theft. Go hack Hillary Clinton and find these emails. And so that's a question that should be asked, because it's curious that Bill Barr would greenlight charges against Julian Assange in 2010, but not greenlight the same charges against WikiLeaks or Donald Trump in 2016. So that's one thing.
That's, I mean,
that's sort of weedy, but I think it's an important question.
No.
The other thing is that you go ahead.
I was going to say I clearly understand that analogy. In fact, the only difference in there is in one instance, you have the former instance where it was an open call by WikiLeaks. The difference is that they're looking for whistleblowers. They're not asking outside, right? I mean, they're specifically asking whistleblowers, people who are working within these agencies. Now, maybe there isn't a legal difference, but it seems to me to be some, at least a difference. And in the case of Trump saying he's addressing the Russians directly in that instance, right? Like he has someone in mind to do the job, as he says it publicly. Now, maybe he was just joking, but maybe WikiLeaks was joking when they said, maybe should we offer a reward for this stuff? I mean, so, all right. I get.
Well, and the evidence in the Mueller report makes it very clear he wasn't joking, because both Cohen and Flynn and Gates and Manafort, they're all on the record saying Donald Trump was really obsessed with getting these emails.
Right.
So, including that same day. So it's, you know, it's like the evidence makes it clear he wasn't joking. That's just one of the many questions in his sworn answers where Trump very clearly lied to Mueller. But whatever, you know, that's just one of many.
Okay. So, all right. So we have that odd choice by Bill Barr. I'm being a little bit facetious to prosecute WikiLeaks for something they did in 2011, and not choosing to do what they did, basically the same thing in 2016. And I should be clear that I think that the prosecution that you just talked about, and I think you have made it very clear, I think is wrong and very, very dangerous for journalism, regardless of what people think about Julian Assange or WikiLeaks or whatnot, because the legal theory can be applied to anybody. They don't need to be Julian Assange for that legal theory, once it's established, to be applied to, I don't know, pick your favorite national security reporter. All right. And
yeah, and I also want to make clear, I'm not saying it should be applied in the 2016 case.
Right.
Because it would be equally dangerous in the 2016 case. I think that whatever Mueller's First Amendment review was, I think that probably was a sound decision. It's EDVA that's not making sound decisions. So,
okay. EDDA.
I'm not calling for anybody. Yeah.
Well, so just tell us what EDDA is.
EDVA is Eastern District of Virginia, which is the judicial district where Assange is being prosecuted. It also happens to be where CIA, ODNI, that's the Director of National Intelligence, and the Pentagon are. And so a lot of the worst precedents for national security whistleblowing are there.
Okay.
And that's one of the reasons why they're prosecuting Assange there, because the precedents are all there.
Okay. So, all right. So with that addressed, I want to go on to what you said about, let's talk about the continuing investigation. And then I want to talk about your most recent post on there is recent evidence that Trump lied in his sworn statement to Mueller, that the Trump Organization withheld responsive emails from a subpoena, and that those emails are available if they want it to, I guess, presumably like the House Judiciary Committee or an impeachment select committee. But let's just start with the continuing investigations. Mueller has ended what he's done, but there are still investigations that continue on that are pertinent to the work that he did.
Right. So there were 14 referrals and I may have this wrong. Altogether, there are 14 cases still out there. I think most of them probably aren't anywhere close to prosecution and may never get close to prosecution. So I think that number is inflated. But what Mueller made clear was there's a bunch of stuff we sent off, mostly to other judicial districts, federal districts. And then there are some cases where they were continuing when we finished, and here's who's in charge of them. And one of those that is unredacted, and there's actually a fight literally as we speak in D.C. right now in Roger Stone's case, is Roger Stone's case. There has been both with journalists trying to get the warrants used against Roger Stone, and importantly, with a Roger Stone ally associate named Andrew Miller, who works on and off for Stone. In the government's responses to their request, the government has said the investigation into Roger Stone is ongoing. And what happened yesterday, and I suspect this coincidence is not at all accidental. So literally minutes after Mueller finished, so Andrew Miller worked for Stone in 2016, was basically his scheduler, including during the RNC. He was interviewed by the FBI in spring of 2018, and Mueller said, "Here's a subpoena." And at first, he was gonna respond to the subpoena, and then some right wing operatives funded a challenge to the subpoena, and the subpoena went all the way to the Supreme. Well, it went through the D.C. District, the D.C. Circuit, and was denied all the time. He was trying to say Mueller has no authority to subpoena me, and that just got sent back. Tried to appeal it all the way to the Supreme Court, that just got, or decided he couldn't, that just got dumped back at the district court. And yesterday, literally minutes after Mueller finished that hearing on whether or not the chief judge in DC was going to hold this guy in contempt, went through and she said, "Yeah, I'm gonna." And she did that based off the representations of the prosecutors, one of whom is a former Mueller prosecutor, a guy by the name of Aaron Zielinski, based on their representations that they still need Miller's testimony for something. And they couldn't have gotten that testimony given the way grand jury subpoenas work. They couldn't get that testimony unless they could convince to her. And they did secret conditions yesterday, in a sidebar, they did convince her that there are new charges that may be out there based on what Andrew Miller testifies to. Now, he's going to testify, as far as we know, Friday morning at 9:30. So
and these would be new charges against Stone, new Roger charges Stone. Against anybody else, or just Roger Stone?
I suggested, actually, after the post you referenced earlier, I suggested in a post today that it appears they're still looking for Russia's hacks, Guccifer 2.0, Assange, and Roger Stone's relationship to all three of those. So it's all the same stuff. There's just, potentially new charges that they may bring against Stone based on what Andrew Miller knows. I don't know what that would be. I had thought that it's clear from something that Stone submitted to court that he was also investigated for wire fraud. And I had thought maybe that's what this was going to be about, because Miller had suggested he was a little worried about his own financial exposure. But it, given what was submitted yesterday, it seems fairly clear it is the same parties. So Assange, Russia, Guccifer 2.0, and WikiLeaks, that these potential new charges would pertain to.
Okay, so that's ongoing. And is there anything else that is extant in terms of that we know about at this point?
One thing that that also is extant that we know, I mean, there are aspects of Michael Cohen's testimony, like there is a lawyer who floated a pardon to him, and they're investigating the way in which pardons were floated to him. We know, for example, and this isn't necessarily, didn't necessarily come out of Mueller, but there are common witnesses. There's still an investigation into the inauguration fund. There's still an investigation into something Manafort lied about that we don't know details of. So we know basic outlines of some of these things. I mean, there was an indictment maybe 2 weeks ago of a guy named Steve Kalk, who's a banker who gave Manafort a loan that no one in their right mind should have given him. And he did it in exchange for a position first in the campaign, and then he hoped in the administration, and he got charged with bribery. So he got hit really hard. That's not a Mueller referral. They said that they don't consider that a Mueller referral. And yet it's something that describes, oh my goodness, is Paul Manafort a crook? I mean, like the way in which he suckered this guy into giving him basically $15 million of loans, based off promising him that he would get him a position in the Trump administration, is just pretty galling stuff. So that's ongoing, pretty damning stuff, not a Mueller referral. And there are a number of cases like that.
So sad, but the other thing when that, you bribe a guy and you can't trust him to it's really sad.
I know. I mean, but I, you know, so I did this, I'm working on this timeline of what we know of the investigation. So when certain warrants were filed, and therefore when the FBI knew about certain, you know, potential crimes, and doing that, I'm just stunned again by how corrupt all these guys are. I mean, Michael Flynn as well, like he was being paid by Turkey, an unregistered foreign agent of Turkey, while he was getting pre-election briefings, top secret briefings, as the president's top national security advisor. So foreign agent getting top secret briefings.
Well, but he's an honorable guy, and so he won't tell.
Right. Yeah.
Internal firewall at the meeting. All right. So let me.
So one more ongoing investigation is, for some reason, when Washington Post tried to get all of the breach declaration related to Paul Manafort. And that's a lot of that stuff does show up in the Mueller report, which is what they told the judge. They're like, just let us have this. And prosecutors in that case, too, are also saying ongoing investigation. So there are aspects of Manafort's behavior which may pertain to his ongoing efforts that went until 2018 to basically push this Ukraine, quote unquote, peace plan, which amounts to carving up Ukraine for Russia's benefit. So that may be what they're continuing to investigate for Manafort, but there is something with Manafort that's still extant as well.
There was at one point, there was a foreign entity company that had been subpoenaed and were fighting the subpoena. Whatever happened to that thread?
We don't know. But again, given what Mueller said, I had, you know, no one has gotten reporting on this. Hopefully now that everyone's done, they can explain this. I couldn't even get people in Congress who should know to be able to explain it. But nobody could explain why Mueller stuck around 2 months after his report was filed. It's quite possible he stuck around until he knew that Miller's testimony, that they would get Miller's testimony. And if that's the case, then he probably stuck around until they got whatever they needed from mystery appellant. So it may be that there is something pending with mystery appellant, which, at least from my read of it, implicated somebody really senior, either really senior or somebody who had the goods on somebody really senior. Like, I don't rule out that it's a Chinese company that was investing in Eric Prince's company, because that clearly had some criminal implications, and there are reasons to think it might have been true. And the reason you might go after Eric Prince is because he knows certain things. He's hiding. He's still not telling the truth about certain things about Trump, that charging him with being a foreign agent of China, being a mercenary of China, basically, might get him more willing to talk about what he knows about Trump. So there are still examples of that. And that's we don't know what happened with Mystery Appellant. And what I just told you was just a hypothesis. I'm not promising it's going to happen, or even that it has come in. I'm just saying that is, for example, a scenario that's possible.
Okay. And one more thing before we get onto the new evidence. And at one point, Mueller said at the end, almost the end of the press conference, I think maybe it was the very end, there were multiple systemic efforts to interfere in our election, and that allegation deserves the attention of every American. Is that him just saying, hey, Donald Trump, despite the fact that you say that there was no interference, there was systemic efforts to do so, and you shouldn't deny that, despite the fact that you did some own sleuthing yourself in asking Putin if he did it. What is there more to that? What does that mean?
The way I took it, and I wrote a post on this, and I've got another piece coming out on it, because it's not just that reference, although I think that reference, so multiple systemic efforts to interfere in our election. He also said he also said that there were numerous efforts emanating from Russia to influence the election. I'm not sure I have that quote exactly right. And he also describes how the two indictments, so the GRU indictment and the IRA indictment, and other activities described in the report, describe Russia's multifaceted effort to interfere in the election. And what I take that language to mean is when Bill Barr, he did his four page memo, he said there are two parts to this. There's the IRA and GRU indictments, and Trump's people didn't conspire there. And then there's the obstruction thing. And because Trump's people didn't conspire with IRA or GRU, the obstruction thing was a no-brainer. He's innocent. And in fact, of course, there are two volumes. There's the obstruction volume and the first volume, which includes the IRA, GRU indictments, and all these descriptions of Russians trying to reach out to Trump people. And I think what he was trying to say is, many, if not most, if not all of those instances that he included in that first volume of that outreach, he considers attempts to interfere in the election. So as an example, when Joseph Mifsud reached out to George Papadopoulos, that was and said, hey, we've got these emails. We want to get a meeting with Putin. We've got these emails. And by the way, a couple things that the report shows, which hasn't gotten a lot of attention. One is that Mifsud has ties to both the IRA operation and the GRU operation. So whether or not he knows Putin's niece, which he lied about, he was very well positioned to know about the operation, the ongoing Russian operation. Another thing we know is that there were aspects that Papadopoulos kept doing that he hid. He had these notes for a meeting with Putin's office in September in London. At the same time, he was complaining about having an FBI informant sent out after him. And he refused to tell the FBI. He refused to help the FBI read his notes on that. So he's still trying to hide the details of what that September meeting was supposed to be. So Papadopoulos is actually more damning than you make out. And then there was this aftermath with a guy named Sergey Milyan, who people kept offering Papadopoulos these jobs. And he was like, it felt really creepy. I thought it was weird. And I'm like, well, if it's weird, call the FBI. You know, like, if you think this guy, like, you know, Million said, we'll give you $30,000 a month if you get a job in the Trump administration.
And that'll be weird.
And Papadopoulos' response was, well, that sounds illegal. And he did nothing about it being illegal and continued to talk to Sergey Million. But and so what I think one of the things Mueller was trying to say with the multiple systemic efforts are, we haven't been, I mean, and I'm this is true of me as well. Like, we haven't been saying the entire volume one is about Russia's effort to interfere in the election. Yes, it is true that no conspiracy involving a Trump official was charged. But Mueller seems to be suggesting that many of those instances, Papadopoulos, Manafort sharing polling data, the effort to get the meeting sharing dirt and asking for sanctions relief, Carter Page, that those are all Russian attempts to reach out to the Trump administration as part of the same operation or as parallel operations. And that's one of the things that I do think was new with Mueller's statement yesterday and was pretty importantly new, because we haven't been thinking, zero people have been thinking in terms of it was all part of the same operation. I mean, it was all part of, like, certainly the outreach to Trump's people. I said earlier, Aras Agalarov, the guy who set up the June 9th meeting, he's really close to Putin. And it would be silly to imagine that Agalarov was doing that without thinking that it somehow might please Putin, especially because we see the head of a different bank later in the report say, yeah, you know, Putin at every quarterly meeting with me has been saying, how can you get to Trump? How can you get me to Trump? How can you own Trump for me? So, you know, it's clear that that's what Putin wants. What Mueller shows in volume one is none of it amounted to criminal behavior that he could charge and prosecute and withstand on appeal on. But that, yeah, it was part of the same effort.
Okay. So, is in some way the fact that it took, I mean, even if it's this, right, that, like, you know, the analogy is like, I hate John McCain. And one side of your advisors says, oh, I know how I can please the boss. Let's put the drape over the USS McCain. And somebody else says, oh, you know what we did is we defaced, you know, a dinghy that had John McCain's name on it. Or, you know, we went out and I told Meghan McCain, go F yourself. Like, all of them go out with the sort of the prime directive of, you know, make me happy about, you know, what happens that is consistent with my hatred of John McCain. But the fact that, I mean, that's one scenario, I guess, that you know, we're talking about, that there was the impetus for all of these different contacts, whether they were coordinated or not, or whether there was a central sort of like repository for these actions, all emanated from a desire that was happening in Russia. Does not the fact that they happen repeatedly over time indicate that the Trump organization, that they never succeeded, that the Trump organization, that, you know, people said kept going up to the Trump campaign and say, do you want to dance? You want to dance? You want to dance? And they kept getting shot down. Or, you know, or like, oh, I need to get a drink, you know, maybe not exactly shot down. Like, no, there wasn't necessarily a no, but it was like, oh, I got to get a drink. And then they came back and they couldn't find each other. I mean, something like that. Like, isn't the fact that they had to continue to try and meet with the Trump people indicative of they never really connected?
I think to some degree it does, although, there are cases that are exceptions to that. I mentioned Papadopoulos. Both before and after the campaign, he was willing to at least entertain these job offers and never really did anything to stop getting the job offers, even after having been interviewed by the FBI about them. Same thing with Carter Page. Even after the FBI started coming after him, he was still like, yeah, I'm going to listen to whatever Russia wants me to do. I want to go into business with them. And particularly with Page, the Mueller report is like, well, we could never figure out exactly what he did in Russia. So the case is not closed on Carter Page. And the case against Carter Page in the report is actually far more damning than ever gets discussed in regards to his FISA application. There's Aras Agalarov, where he definitely tried after the election to capitalize on the relationship and on that meeting and to kind of say, well, you promised us. And that may be, I think one of the things that's over and over again, we see Trump's very venal loser associates still know that something's wrong when Trump doesn't. So I think Steve Bannon actually saved Trump in a number of positions, including when he became the guy in charge right after the election saying, no, we're not going to take this dangle in the way it was given. And then another really important point of continuity that we actually don't see all of in the report, but is clearly there, is with Sergei Kislyak. So it's clear that he's making outreaches to everybody during the election, and his outreaches after the election to Mike Flynn formed the basis of his charges, right? So he kept talking to Kislyak and eventually convinced him not to retaliate for sanctions based off assurances that Trump would fix sanctions, right? What's important about Flynn and that relationship is many parts of that relationship are actually not in the report. So meetings going back to 2015, not in the report, even though we know that they were part of an FBI counterintelligence investigation. And to understand why Mueller didn't charge Flynn for, according to the public record at least, basically going rogue and reaching out secretly to the Russian ambassador and saying, I'm going to fix these sanctions, given the investigation that was already started into him, it should have been a no-brainer. I mean, it should have been like, you just spied for Russia, and he wasn't charged for spying for Russia, so Mueller must know more. And I suspect that one of the things that Flynn cooperated on that we can't see is to talk about that longer relationship. And so Kislyak is somebody for whom there was more continuity. There are a couple of other people that actually do show up again and again. And many of them are hedgies, American hedge funders, right, who have business in Russia. And I think one of the criticisms of people that is absolutely right about the Russian investigation is, first of all, it set off this kind of suspicion of all things Russia. I think it flattened the notion of what is Russian. So a lot of Georgians or Azeris or Ukrainians or Cypriots or what have you are treated as Russian when they're not. I mean, they might have interests in common with Russia, but they're obviously not Russians, and that all got flattened out. But if you look at the report, one of the weak points, I mean, if you want to say there's this counterintelligence threat of Russia coming in and selling us out and having Americans sell us out, the weak point is not necessarily Russian business people, but it's like these hedge fund people in New York. Richard Burt is one. There's a guy named Forsman who's another, who keeps coming back and keeps, you know, offering these back channel meetings, just like Russian bankers were. There was a guy, Rick Gerson, who with a Russian banker basically planned the first phone meeting between Trump and Putin. It wasn't anyone in the White House. It was these bankers in D.C. and in Moscow who were doing it together. And that's one of the things that is a little alarming, and that frankly justifies where Congress is going and subpoenaing all these bank records, because, you know, these New York bankers, they don't care about America. They care about making business deals. And right. And that's the way you're going to get it. And it's not just the Trump administration, although the Trump administration, I think, is extremely susceptible because they're all venal and they all have no moral compass. Not all, but most are venal and most have no moral compass. And therefore, when some guy comes up offering a wad of cash, they're going to say yes.
I mean, isn't
and they're
that,
not going to think through who's behind that cash.
Isn't that probably what was largely behind all of this, was on some level the people closest to Trump anticipated he would lose. There was this huge pile of cash in the form of like a building that they wanted to build in Russia. And it was more like, you know, to the extent that anything was promised that we would look at, you know, after we win, it's sort of like, we're not going to win. So, yeah, promise them. And let's just keep a good relationship with these folks, because this is the way that you make a business deal, right? Like, you know,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah. And this will segue me to the Cohen stuff, to the Trump Tower Moscow stuff. I do suspect the details of the Trump Tower Moscow, when you read Michael Cohen talking to the House Intelligence Committee, he sounds like a dope. I mean, first of all, like Mueller has said, and Cohen has said, and Sater has said, this deal was worth $300 million. And if that's true, it is literally too good to be true. And so a lot of people are like, it wasn't a real deal because the money doesn't add up. And I think a better way of understanding it was, you need to think a little bit about why this deal is too good to be true, huh. Right? And why Felix Sater kept pitching it in certain ways and certain times that really served Russia's interest, and why Felix Sater said, if you do this, you'll win the election, and why Trump and Cohen made certain decisions in conjunction with the schedule of the election. I don't think Michael Cohen is being fully honest about all of that. He sounds really idiotic when he says, oh, yeah, Felix Sater mentioned the election and I didn't think anything of it. Oh, yeah, I was holding off on scheduling these meetings until after the primary. But don't take don't make any connection between the election and this deal. But it seems clear the Russians behind that deal, which includes people from GRU, did keep that in mind. So it may have been Cohen was telling himself a fiction because he thought he'd get rich. But the Russians knew exactly what they were doing. And that is a perfect example. But when you look at some of the rest of Michael Cohen's testimony, I mean, even when the House Oversight Committee, he's like, Trump thought he had a 3% chance of winning the election. For him, it was an infomercial. It was just branding. It was just a great marketing opportunity. And that's why, Mueller and Congress have him dead to rights on lying under oath to Mueller about the Trump Tower deal. Because the Trump, basically Trump in his sworn answers about the Trump Tower deal to Mueller said, basically repeated the Michael Cohen story that he's now sitting in prison for having told. You know, he said that it stopped early. There were very few conversations, no conversations with anybody else in the family, no talk of traveling to Russia, all false. And all the false story that Michael Cohen told to Congress back in 2017, Trump kept telling that same false story. And oh, by the way, his personal lawyer was involved in writing that story with Michael Cohen. And that is the sworn story that Trump told Mueller. Now, after it became clear that Cohen had cooperated on that, then Trump and Rudy Giuliani started running their mouth. And they're like, oh, yeah, well, the answers that we wrote, we meant those to carry all the way through until after the election. And that's the first that Mueller had. I actually suspect Cohen was not telling the full truth about how long the deal went. But that's the first that Mueller was told by somebody, by Trump, you know, in a public interview, that in fact he kept the deal going until, he stopped it after the election, maybe reluctantly. But that's what Trump wanted. He didn't want to be president of the United States. He wanted this too good to be true offer. And it really served the Russian goals to keep that offer on there, because it meant that Trump was always going to be willing to say what they wanted him to say and to take meetings and to do X, Y, and Z.
Right.
And so the Trump Tower deal is not a crime. It is not a crime to entertain a deal which is too good to be true that you should really think more about why somebody's offering you the deal. But Trump is too narcissistic. I mean, he's, a narcissist is not going
to
do that.
I have some alternate theories about that to a certain extent, but the pursuing, like changing policy because you think it's going to lead to a good business deal for you, or coming out with policies and then, carrying through on those policies after you're president because you think like your kids are going to be able to make that deal or whatever it is. It's not a crime, but it's certainly something that's impeachable, it seems to me, right? Like, you're as president, you're not supposed to be acting, you're not supposed to be sort of forging U.S. policy based upon developing a good relationship with the country so that you can get a business deal there. I mean, that's not what you're supposed to be doing. I mean, it also strikes me is that Donald Trump could have believed it, not just out of his, you know, his sort of just his pride and or his ignorance on some level, like Felix Sater is a money launderer. You know, maybe that $300 million, there's no doubt in my mind that when they build stuff, they pad budgets. They hide money. This is the way you skim, right? Like it's a $300 million deal, and maybe it costs like $2.25 million to build the thing, and then you've got $75 million. I mean, they did it with the inauguration, as far as I can tell. This is a super expensive inauguration, and we were able to, you know, shuttle off whatever it is, $25 million to Melania's friend, and then for doing whatever, and then we don't know where that money went. I mean, that's so. All right. So of the stuff that we know, Trump has lied to his in his sworn statement to Mueller. That could come up in an impeachment hearing. They withheld emails from a subpoena, and those emails are gettable now, right?
Yeah.
Because Mueller had them basically dipped in amber, more or less, right? I mean, is that what happened?
Well, and also because Trump, for a really corrupt businessman, doesn't conduct his business in a really safe way. Google and Microsoft both offer as a service to enterprises, which means either usually big businesses and also college universities. They offer to run their email system. You don't know that they're running your email system. So, for example, Temple University, twice the government has been able to go to Google, who runs their email system, and get emails from a professor and from a student there that if they had gone to Temple, Temple would have been forced to make a First Amendment challenge to the subpoena, to the warrant. And that's true of virtually everyone who uses Microsoft or Google to do their email services, is that the government's going to go to Google and Microsoft because Google and Microsoft, you know, they're going to follow the law, but they're going to follow the law. But also Google and Microsoft, because of the way the government does this, aren't going to be able to give the business or the university an opportunity to challenge the warrant, which normally would happen. And this is a problem that affects everyone. And Microsoft, to their credit, has changed this somewhat. And ironically, they got DOJ to change the rules in October 2017. In July 2017, well, in June 2017, as Mueller was looking closer at Michael Cohen, he's like, whoa, there's some stuff there. And he calls up Microsoft and says, please preserve all of Michael Cohen's. Oh, so what the kicker on this is that Microsoft provides Trump Organization's emails.
Okay.
So there are two ways you can get Trump Organization emails. You can go to Trump Organization and deal with Trump and his lawyers, and they're all corrupt, or you can deal with Microsoft and they're going to follow the law. And so what FBI did twice in 2017 that we know of is first just with Michael Cohen and maybe others, and then a second time for everybody in the company, the FBI called up and said, hey, do us a favor and dip those in amber. And so since July of 2017, everybody at Trump Organization's emails have been dipped in amber, have been preserved by Microsoft. And what appears to have happened with various things that Mueller was investigating is he'd asked Trump Organization to voluntarily comply, and they would say they did. And then at the same time, Mueller and the FBI were going to Microsoft and saying, hey, can you give us all these emails?
And the Trump people
didn't. And then Mueller was looking at the two.
And Trump,
the Trump people didn't figure that out.
They didn't know that Mueller was basically setting them up to lie to him.
And so then Mueller subpoenaed that stuff in, I think, March of 2018 and probably still didn't get full compliance. And so and three of the emails. So that's what happened with Mueller and the FBI. But at the same time, it just so happens that by freak of chance, Michael Cohen is one of the only Trump people that Congress decided to subpoena. And it's a freak of chance. There's not a really good explanation for it, but they did. They subpoenaed Michael Cohen. And most of the documents that they wanted from Michael Cohen back in May of 2017, he didn't have. Trump Organization had. So he went to Trump Organization's lawyer, a guy named Alan Garten, and said, hey, can you pull all of these emails so that I can comply with this subpoena from Congress? And Alan Garten, before he gave, this is according to Michael Cohen's sworn testimony to HPSI, Alan Garten, before he gave those documents to Michael Cohen, looked at them and said, how are we going to tell a story that's not damning to the boss? And he pulled the emails that proved the Trump Tower deal went past the Iowa caucus. So those emails were not delivered to the House Intelligence Committee, even though they were subpoenaed. And guess who signed that subpoena? It wasn't Adam Schiff. It was Devin Nunes. So Trump Organization refused to comply with a valid subpoena signed by a Republican back in 2017. And when Michael Cohen was testifying in March, basically, you could see Adam Schiff. I'm reading the transcript, and you could see Adam Schiff's mind going wild because he's like, wait a second. These emails were not handed over to us as part of our subpoena. So that's how, like, now Adam Schiff has proof that Alan Garten did not comply with the subpoena, but I've added now the added bit, which says, Adam Schiff, guess where you can go get those emails?
Right.
You don't have to fight.
You don't have
with
to surmise
bar to
that,
get it.
Right.
You can just go to Microsoft, and once you get this, you know, once you get those court rulings that say this is of course a valid subpoena, just ask Microsoft, and they're going to give it to you, and then you're going to have smoking gun proof that Trump Organization told the lie that Michael Cohen is sitting in prison for. Trump Organization and Jay Sekulow and Donald Trump, not Michael Cohen.
Wow.
I mean, Michael Cohen did too.
Well,
but
now that's
going to
involve
time, so.
Nancy Pelosi basically saying, okay, we can go forward with this. And that's a different issue. All right. So lastly, one more thing I want to ask you about. In every post that you have written since, I guess maybe a year or so now, you've had a disclaimer.
Forever and ever and ever.
Right, a disclaimer, yeah. at the end about having turned in a source. I can't remember the date in which we discussed that on this program, but it was a source whom, if I recall correctly, had contacted you the day after the election of Donald Trump, had informed you of a meeting that was going to take place. You didn't think much of it. You thought the source was sort of talking out of their ass. Subsequent to that, Jared Kushner testified that meeting actually did take place in retrospect. And I think it was Ignatius in the Washington Post maybe had reported on that meeting as well. And you put two and two together and said, there's no reason why this person should have known that. But the fact that they did know that leads me to believe that they were involved with these people in a way that doesn't make sense unless X, Y, or Z. I mean, I don't know all the factors that went through your mind. So you went to the FBI.
Let me interrupt for a sec. That's not why I went to the FBI.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. So then do tell. But up to that point, had I gotten the story straight?
Well, it is true that I showed that text and that I had no idea why this person would know what Mike Flynn was up to 48. I mean, he literally told me about it 14 hours after the polls closed.
Okay.
So that, you know, that has nothing to do with the main reasons I went to the FBI. There was something that people don't know and still did not know was part of the election year attack. Or at least I have reason to understand that it was. And that was the urgent reason I went to the FBI. Something was happening, something was ongoing, and there was actual harm happening. And I felt that I couldn't just write about it. I couldn't fix it by reporting. And I couldn't, at the same time, in good conscience, watch that continued harm to happen. So that's the urgent reason I went. And then an aspect of what I went to the FBI about, and I don't know how much, and I don't know the terms of it, But an aspect of what I went to the FBI about did get moved under Mueller, such that when I spoke with Mueller's office a year ago, they were grateful that I had reached out to them. And beyond that, what I've just told you, that the main urgent reason why I went to the FBI and that the person this involves has absolutely nothing that I understand to do with Trump people, also explains why the advent of the Mueller report doesn't actually change things. Doesn't, you know, what we see in the Mueller report doesn't say to me one way or another how much of what I went to the FBI about they were able to corroborate or not, or how much, or whether they've, you know, since decided they've chased down all the leads and decided that it was nothing. I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to say more than that. I do know or think I know more than that, but I'll just say that the Mueller report does not change where I was at a year ago when I talked to you.
So
about my understanding of where that's at.
So let me ask you that question. Do you anticipate that there will be, we will know a story that will involve this individual in the future and things will become clearer? Or is this basically the end of that story as far as you, you will reveal publicly?
There is a crime that if DOJ can charge it, they will charge it. And so if they charge it and it doesn't, and it's not the person I thought it was, then I will know at that point that I was wrong about that aspect of it. There's also part of it that, but it's not clear they're ever going to be able to get the evidence to actually charge that. These things happen. And then there are other aspects of this that might not be charged for other reasons. So I don't know. I mean, I can promise you that the FBI does not call me up with updates to tell me exactly
right.
What's going on. That's the last thing. I mean, you know, yes, we sat in a room and had a conversation together, but it's not like we're pen pals at all at this point.
So it's possible that this is the end of that story that we're going to hear from you if there is no further action by the FBI. Is that the case?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose there's at some point where I will, you know, come around to saying to explain a bit about it, but now's definitely not that time. It would be, I'm certain that now is not that time.
It'll be sometime in the future, but you can't give a timeline for it.
Yeah, but you and I have a standing date that I said 2 years from the time when we talked, I would tell you about how weird it is to talk to the FBI. So maybe that's when we should revisit, which I think is probably about 15 months in the future. But we can get back together.
Okay.
And I can tell you how weird it is for somebody like me to talk to the FBI.
All right. Well, Marcy, thank you for, we kept you on for a long time. Let me reiterate, I apologize for that.
And I apologize to all your listeners who think I should not be on the show. I'm sorry for spoiling Sam's show.
I'm not sure it was listeners that had a problem with you being on the show, but as long as the apologies are out there, all apologies, I'm sure we've covered everyone we need to cover with that. All right. Well, so let me ask you this just lastly about that source thing. Just finally, do you have regrets about that, or are you still convinced?
None.
Okay.
Zero. None. None.
And
nope.
I mean, we have to take your word that you actually did any of that for all we know at this point, right? Like, I mean, who knows?
Yes, that's true. Although I think that I've made enough claims about Mueller's investigation that they might have corrected me if that was all made up. So,
right. Okay. Fair enough. Marcy Wheeler, thanks so much. Folks can read more at emptywheel.net. I really appreciate your time today.
Thanks, Sam.
Bye. There you have it, folks. A lot of stuff in there. A lot of stuff for, I will implore you. You can listen to it. Audible has a free download. Maybe we should put a link to that in our podcast description today. Here we go. Michael Tracy took a screenshot. Cool guest. I heard she has some big ethical problems, though, you know? The whole fairy tale she concocted about going to the FBI and becoming a big player in the Mueller investigation, the explosive evidence of collusion she claimed she possessed. Other than that, cool guest.
I think that's sarcasm.
Oh, he's being sarcastic. Look at that. Oh, there you go.
The issue that about what Marcy did with turning in her own source to the FBI, not be in the.
That's gotta hurt. That's gotta hurt.
It's just the Glenn clip saying he respects Marcy Wheeler as a journalist and doesn't think you should apologize for having him on.
Oh, well, all right, that's good to know. Oh, gosh. Super producer Matt Leck, ladies and gentlemen, doing his Twitter foo, as it were. We will put a link to the audio of the Mueller report in our podcast description. I just listen to the first two chapters. That will take you maybe an hour. Maybe we should have just play it. Rip it from Audible.
Just stream it. We might be able to find a public domain version that won't sue us for it.
Well, maybe we should just read it. Do like the first two chapters. Maybe I'll do that.
Another media property did that and they got a lot of views for it.
I think somebody might have suggested that on day one. And then I was poo-pooed, I think, by people in this office. Anyways, speaking of poo-poo, you can become a member of the Majority Report by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only support the free show, we give you extra content every day, and we give it to you ad-free. So jointhemajorityreport.com. It is the members that make this show independent. It is, it's hugely important to what we do. Like every time I make a calculation about hiring somebody or expanding the show or, you know, trying to pay, you know, give raises or whatever it is a function of our members. We make some money through YouTube, obviously. And some money through advertising, but at the end of the day, it's our members because, members won't decide one day like, oh, we're going to demonetize this channel or,
Hashtag, gotta jump
or well, hashtag gotta jump, but look how hard those guys have been working and they, you know, even with their incredible efforts,
they haven't affected the numbers at all.
Well, it may not be the case, but it is, it's still tough. Those gotta jump guys they're not easy. But the point is that, it is our membership that is at the core of this program. And, by becoming a member, it is much appreciated. With that said, if you don't have the finances, I don't want people to put themselves in any type of financial stress to support the program. There's a lot of different ways you can support the show. Go give us a review on iTunes. Tell your friends. When we get merch, wear a shirt if we ever, you know, can get our act together. If you want the extra content but don't have the finances, send an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We have hooked up hundreds upon hundreds of folks, and we are happy to do it. We don't want to kick anybody out for financial reasons. Michael is on a retreat, silent retreat.
That's why I think tonight in the feed I'm going to put a litter hangover episode. So I'm going to take over the feed.
Well, the cat's away.
Yep.
The mouse will play.
Poach some audience.
There you go. You should do like for every, cause there's still some food there apparently. Check out TMBS and get, a double dose of literary hangover. Also, you can check out the Antifada at patreon.com/theantifada. What's happening on Literary Hangover?
People should check out the Margaret Fuller episode, which is the most recent one, especially if they don't know who she is, because I feel like she should definitely be more known. She's an early feminist and a sort of socialist, utopian socialist, and very interesting. And she died off of Fire Island in a shipwreck, actually.
There you go.
Yeah, after it famously saying that women should be able to become sea captains. There's some dark irony there.
Yeesh. All right, quick break, fun half. See you there.
Okay.